Going on anyway in chapter 37, it came to pass when King Hezekiah heard, he rent his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth and went into the house of the Eternal. And he sent Eliakim, who was over the household, and Shebna the scribe and the elders of the priest, covered with sackcloth, unto Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos. Well, they said to him, thus says Hezekiah, this day is a day of trouble and of rebuke and of blasphemy. For the children are come to the birth, and there's not strength to bring forth. Now, some of the authorities believe that Hezekiah wrote these songs of degrees, and they may well be right, because a lot of the psalms back in, you might turn back and notice a few of these in Psalm 122. There are a lot of parallels with what he's saying here in this part of Isaiah. I was glad when they said unto me, let's go into the house of the Eternal. Our feet will stand within your gates, O Jerusalem. Jerusalem's built as a city that's compact together. Now, some of these may have been written by Hezekiah, and some of them may have been written by David. Verse 9, because of the house of the Eternal, our God, I'll seek your good. Then Psalm 134, behold, bless you the Eternal, all servants of the Eternal, which by night stand in the house of the Eternal. Lift up your hands in the sanctuary and bless the Eternal. The Eternal that made heaven and earth, bless you out of Zion. Now, quite a few of the terms that are used here in Isaiah, we'll see a little later, are actually written once again in these songs of degrees. In Psalm 130, out of the depths I've cried unto you, O Eternal. So some think the dark day that he was writing about there was when he wrote this psalm. Out of the depths I've cried unto you, O Eternal. Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my supplications. Now, whether some of these are directly references to this trouble going on at that time or not, there are quite a few parallels in some of these songs of degrees. In fact, some people think that he wrote some of these because of the episode of the sundial going back 10 degrees, and that he had 15 years added to his life, so he put these 15 psalms together. Of course, they had the 15 steps in the temple, and they'd sing one of these on each of the steps in kind of a ceremony or a ritual at the feast time. So there may be a lot of parallels there, and maybe we can have more time to check out the possibility later on. Come back to Isaiah once again. Some of the statements used here are almost identical back in Kings, where the same history is recounted back there. Verse 3, this day is the day of trouble and of rebuke and of blasphemy, for the children are come to the birth and there's not strength to bring forth. So that's the kind of a predicament they were in, as if a mother was right there ready to deliver a baby, but it wouldn't be born. It may be the Eternal, your God, will hear the words of Rabshakeh, whom the king of Assyria, his master, has sent to reproach the living God. So maybe God will hear what he said and will reprove the words which the Eternal, your God, has heard. Wherefore, lift up your prayer for the remnant that's left. So Sennacherib had devoured the northern families, and the Assyrians had taken Israel captive, but they said, lift up your prayer for the remnant, the few tribes that are left out of all of Israel. So the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah, and Isaiah said to them, thus you'll say to your master, thus says the Eternal, don't be afraid of the words you heard, wherewith the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Behold, I'll send a blast on him, and he'll hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I'll cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. So God agitated trouble from another enemy, and he heard the rumors of it, as we'll read a little later, and turned and fled and left the area. So Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria warring against Libnah, because he'd heard that he was departed from Lachish. So he heard say concerning Terhakah, king of Ethiopia, he's come forth to make war with you. And when he heard it, he sent messengers to Hezekiah, saying, thus you'll speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah. Don't let your God in whom you trust deceive you, saying Jerusalem will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Behold, you've heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all lands by destroying them utterly. Shall you be delivered? Have the gods of the nations delivered those which my fathers have destroyed? So here he goes back several generations to how the power that was there had conquered and devastated and transplanted peoples and ruled. The gods of the nations haven't delivered them, which my fathers have destroyed, as Gozan and Haran and Rezeph, the children of Eden that were in Telassar. Some of these are over along the Euphrates and Mesopotamia, and some of them on up in what's modern Syria and Iran. Where is the king of Hamath, and the king of Arphad, and the king of the city of Sepharvaim, Enan and Iva? So Hezekiah received a letter from the hand of the messengers and read it. And Hezekiah went up unto the house of the Eternal and spread it before the Eternal. And that's always an inspiration, you know, to think that when somebody sends you a threat or some kind of a warning, you can just take that and spread it out before God and say, well, God, you listen to what this school board says. I'm going to give all of our students F if they go to the feast. And God, would you read this letter now? This guy says, if I go to the feast, I won't have a job when I come back. And you know, that's always kind of a simple way to do it. You just take it in and spread it out before God and say, well, now, God, look what these people are writing against you. Well, these are your days. This is your way. You drafted me into this, God. This is your battle. And that's really a smart thing to do, and that's why Hezekiah always succeeded. Because he always had that same habit. He'd go up to the house of the Eternal and spread it before the Eternal. Wasn't his problem, you know. They weren't his people. Wasn't his country. But a little later, you'll find out he got a little big-headed and began to think about the great work that he'd built and all the greatness of his work and everything. And, well, Hezekiah prayed unto the Eternal, saying, O Eternal of hosts, God of Israel, that dwells isn't really a good translation there, but reigns between the cherubim, that are the God. You are the God. You're the only God. You're He, the real God. You alone of all the kingdoms of the earth. You've made heaven and earth. All these other so-called gods, you've created all of them. Or if they've got gods that are rivers, or the sun, or the moon, or the stars, you created all them. And if they've got gods that are made out of stone and wood, you created all those trees and all those ingredients for cement. And you know, Mr. Armstrong always goes back to God being the creator. Paul did in Acts, and God's servants, Daniel did too. So that's a biblical trait of God's servants. They always go back to saying, well, wait a minute now. This is the creator God. This is a God by evidences above all the other gods, because he's made everything that people proclaim are gods. Incline your ear, O Eternal. You know, that's an unusual statement. It's kind of like, well, God, you're not listening very closely up there. Bend your head over and, you know, incline your ear. You know, if you're talking to someone and they're not really paying any attention to you, and you just say, Bill, turn your ear over here and listen. That used to frighten me when I'd read how men in the Bible prayed. And I remember the first time I got down on my knees with Mr. Armstrong and anointing somebody with a flu over in Big Sandy. You know, I was ready to get up and get out of there, because he was telling God what he had to do and what he promised he'd do, and he couldn't break his word, and he was bound to do this, and I never heard anybody pray like that in my life before. But look what Isaiah or Hezekiah says. Incline your ear, O Eternal, and hear. That's kind of frightening to think about doing that, saying that to God. Open your eyes, O Eternal, and see. And hear all the words of Sennacherib, which has sent to reproach the living God. Of a truth, Eternal, the kings of Assyria have laid waste all the nations and their countries. And of a truth, they have cast their gods into the fire, but they weren't gods. Otherwise, you couldn't burn them in fire. They're just the work of men's hands. Wood, stone, that's why they've been able to destroy them. Now, therefore, O Eternal, our God, save us from his hand, that all the kings of the earth may know that you're the Eternal, you only, There's only one God. There's only one great God, true God, living God. Then Isaiah, the son of Amos, sent to Hezekiah, saying, "Thus says the eternal God of Israel, whereas you have prayed to me against Sennacherib, king of Assyria." Now, you know, there are a lot of parallels in the statements and attitudes of this king of Assyria to the one that's going to be the beast power in the end time, too. And you think about some of the things this king of Assyria had to say to God's people. They may well try that again. You know, the false prophet might come along and the beast and try to tell God's people exactly what Rabshakeh and Sennacherib tried to tell them back in Hezekiah's day. Try to get us divided, try to get us to reason and not follow our leader, not believe what he says. So when you read Isaiah 36 and 37 and 38, you might read it over a few times. One time just read it as if it's talking about the beast and the false prophet in the end time. Then another time just read it as history. And then maybe another time read it as prophecy of that old day. But a lot of the things said here are typical of the false prophet and the beast in the end time. So Isaiah, anyway, sends to Hezekiah, "Thus says the eternal God of Israel, whereas..." Now you notice he still calls him the eternal God of Israel, though 10 tribes are already gone. And they admitted they were gone. They talked about Samaria not being able to deliver any of them. And when he talked about what's left, he talks about the remnant that's left. But you know, some modernists would have you believe that enough of those 10 tribes stayed behind and came down into the south, that all the 12 tribes continued in Palestine under the leadership of Judah. And that's not true. You don't find that in the Bible. But that's what some people would have you believe. Now, of course, other people would have you believe, since the Assyrians took the Israelites captive, and later on Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians took the Jews captive, they were in captive in such close proximity that they ended up amalgamating together and ended up being the 12 tribes. And then when the Jews came back out of Babylon, then that was all the 12 tribes. And that isn't true either. Because it doesn't say that in Daniel, you know. It talks about Israel that's far off.
Of course, that's God's interventions in history. Well, God brought on Cyrus and caused all his victories and gave him instructions as to how to deal with Palestine. He pursued them, passed safely by the way he had gone with his feet. Who has wrought and done it, calling the generations from the beginning? I am the eternal, the first, and with the last. I am he. The isle saw it and feared, and the ends of the earth were afraid, and they drew near and came. They helped everyone his neighbor, and everyone said to his brother, "Be of good courage." So here were adjoining countries counseling one another about the way they should deal with Cyrus. So the carpenter encouraged the goldsmith, and he that smooth with a hammer, him that smote the anvil, saying, "It's ready for the soldering," and he fastened it with nails that it shouldn't be moved. "But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend." That's unique terminology, you know. Not too many people in the Bible you find that. David was a man after God's own heart, but was he God's friend? "Abraham, my friend, whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called you from the chief men thereof." So you notice, according to God's terminology there, the descendants of Abraham are the chief men of the earth from all down through history. "And said to you, 'You're my servant. I have chosen you and not cast you away. So don't you fear. I'm with you. Don't be dismayed. I'm your God. I'll strengthen you. Yea, I'll help you. Yea, I'll uphold you.'" So he's kind of giving you the message here that he tells you in chapter 40, that you should comfort my people, speak comfortably to them, and now he's telling you what to think, and he's giving you his own words of comfort. "Behold, all they that were incensed against you," all those European beast power nations, "they're going to be ashamed and confounded. They're going to be as nothing. They that strive with you are going to perish. You're going to seek them, and you'll not find them. Then that contended with you, they that war against you are going to be as nothing and as a thing of naught." So Edom and Babylon are going to be burning desolations the first part of the millennium. "I, the eternal, your God, I'm going to hold your right hand and say to you, don't be afraid, I'll help you. Don't be afraid, you worm Jacob. You really are just a grub. Same word as grub, grubworm. You go from fly to worm and back to fly to worm again, you men of Israel. I'll help you, says the Eternal. Incidentally, it says, you few men of Israel, you remnant, you small number that's left, I'll help you, says the Eternal, and your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Behold, I'll make you a new sharp threshing instrument, having teeth. So God's going to use Israel in the beginning of the millennium to bring nations into subjection and under authority and into God's way. You'll thresh these nations about you, and in Europe, they're going to be dealt with, beat them small and make the hills as chaff. You'll fan them, and the wind shall carry them away, and the whirlwind shall scatter them, and you'll rejoice in the Eternal, and you'll glory in the Holy One of Israel. When the poor and needy seek water, and there's none, their tongue fails for thirst, I, the Eternal, will hear them, and will send rains and open underground rivers. And I, the God of Israel, I won't forsake them. I'm going to open rivers in high places. I'm going to cause fountains to burst out of the midst of the valleys. I'm going to make the wilderness a pool of water. The dry land is going to be springs of water. I'm going to plant in the wilderness the cedar, all these different trees, myrtle, olive. I'll set in the desert fir tree, pine, box together, that they may see and know and consider and understand together the hand of the Eternal has done this. The Holy One of Israel has created it. Now, how do you think God's going to set those trees there? Just wave his magic wand and say, zap, 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 you know, and just going to have all these trees all of a sudden pop up out of the ground? No, I don't believe that. I believe we're going to go out there and teach these people how to plant the trees and things that we're going to have to be taught ourselves. But I don't think God's going to wave a magic wand and you're going to have a utopian, beautiful world just instantaneously in a few years. Well, you know, I'd be happy if he did it that way to save a lot of work. But people don't learn a whole lot that way. Produce your cause, says the Eternal. Bring forth your strong reason, says the King of Jacob. That's a great title for God, isn't it? The King of Jacob. That has to be Christ. Let them bring them forth and show us what shall happen. Let them show the former things what they be, that we may consider them and know the latter end of them and declare us things for to come. In other words, are there any other books or beings that are able to prophesy and it happen? I mean, great major events. Show the things that are to come hereafter, that we may know that you're God. So in God's own words, that's one way of knowing God is God. Look what all he foretold, major events in world history that happened. And nobody else has ever been able to do that. No other religious books, no other religious leaders. Only the Bible, only God's prophets have been able to show us what God is foretelling and making happen. Do good or do evil, that we may be dismayed and behold it together. That's another way you can know God. When he says something's good and you try it out, it is. And when he says something's bad and you learn the hard way, it is. So that's another way you can depend on God. Behold, you're of nothing, your work of naught, an abomination is he that chooses you. Any of these other things that claim to be God, any of the other religions or God, they're of nothing. Their work is naught. An abomination is he that chooses you. Well, I've raised up one from the north, and he's going to come from the rising of the sun. He'll call upon my name. He'll come upon princes as upon mortar and as the potter treads clay. Who has declared from the beginning that we may know, and before time that we may say, he's righteous. Yea, there's none that shows, yea, there's none that declares. Nobody's been able to do what God's been able to do, to foretell all these major events and they happen. Yea, there's none that hears your word. The first shall say to Zion, behold, behold them, and I'll give to Jerusalem one that brings good tidings. For I beheld, and there was no man even among them, there was no counselor, that when I asked of them could answer a word. No, none of these gods or religions, not even among the humans of Zion and the leaders. God beheld and asked any man, and none of them had any counsel or any answers. Behold, they're all vanity. Their works are nothing. Their molten images are wind and confusion. But in some of the chapters coming up, there are some terms, like in chapter 45, he talks about the anointed and subduing nations before him, and it's the same phraseology as here. And there it's for sure talking about Cyrus. But in a dual sense, it could be referring to Christ. The righteous from the east called him, gave the nations before him, made him rule over kings. We should get into chapter 45 next time, so we'll parallel that with this chapter 41 and look at them together. Chapter 41, I might make one comment. There seems to be a variance depending on what source you read as far as who the righteous man from the east in verse 2 was. Most of the Jewish element seems to think that it's referring to Abraham, and others seem to think it's referring to Cyrus. Some mention because it talks about the righteous from the east, that it's more than likely talking about Abraham here. And yet, the people that think it's talking about Cyrus say the righteousness doesn't have to do with the individual, but it has to do with God using him as an instrument to bring right, bring justice or equity, or to bring to pass God's plan or God's purpose. In the Sanfino, they make a comment here about this particular verse. He raised up the righteous from the east, visually Cyrus. The Targum and Jewish commentators understand it as a patriarch Abraham, but this is less appropriate to the text. And when they talk about righteous, they mention that here it's with a sense of vindication of the right, that Cyrus was used to vindicate the right, and his conquest may indeed have already begun at this time. So we'll try to nail it down any further than that. Maybe you can learn more by considering it both ways and just putting it in your mind that it can either be talking about Cyrus or Abraham, and of course primarily it's talking about Christ in the future, ultimately. What you get into in the 40 chapters of Isaiah is God continually is talking about a servant that he raises up. In some cases he's talking about Cyrus. In some cases he's talking about Christ in the future. In some cases he's talking about Israel. Of course, if you read in Jewish commentaries or Jewish ideas, they're going to eliminate the idea that it could be a prophecy about the Messiah. As a matter of fact, back in Daniel, where most of us have always understood the key prophecy about the Messiah being born at a time and cut off in the middle of the week and causing sacrifice and oblation to cease, it's kind of interesting sometime to read that in a Jewish commentary, or read it in Sanfino, or somewhere where they don't want any of these references to be about a Messiah, other than one that's coming as an intervening king to restore the empire back to Israel. So where it talks about a redeemer, they'll always make it refer to physical redemption from a battle or a war. And when it talks about a savior, they never use it spiritually. They always use it as referring to being saved from an enemy or being saved from a captivity. In Daniel chapter 9, we understand the 70 weeks prophecy that are determined on the people of Israel, on the holy city. So that shows who it refers to, it's upon them, and then he begins to tell what all is going to be involved in those 70 weeks. To finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Now, how anybody could read that and not realize that's talking about the Messiah. It's talking about Christ coming, living, being crucified, coming back again. Quite often when the Bible, the way the Bible writes, it'll give you a summary first. like Genesis 1, the summary of creation. Then it backtracks and fills in some of the details. And that's what he does here. First of all, he tells you about 70 weeks. And then he says, now let's break that down a little further. And that's what he does here. But according to the Tonsino and the Jewish ideas, you have two different princes referred to here. They think one might even refer to Herod. And they've come up with time periods that have 3.5 years. They've come up with time periods that have 69 weeks and 7 weeks. So they make all of this physical to get around any prophecies about a Messiah, about Christ coming and being born and crucified and fulfilling the 70 weeks prophecy. And then in verse 25 he says, know therefore and understand from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince. Of course, when we read that, it's very plain and common and very easily understood, because it's talking about from the time the decree to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple and everything, the streets and all, unto the Messiah the Prince would be 7 weeks plus 62 weeks. Then he adds as a after comment, the street shall be built again after those weeks, and the wall. So the street and the wall would come after that time and would be in troublous times. Now he comes back again and backtracks again and says, now, after those 62 weeks. But you know, if you were to write this down, first you'd have 70 weeks, then you'd have a summary comment about what's going to happen during that time period of 70 weeks. Then you break it down and you have 7 plus 62. And what's mentioned in verse 25. And then again, you have something else after those 62, which are, of course, after the 7. That's when the Messiah would be cut off, but not for himself.